the Jogcast, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, with Fiona Healy, Monique Hansen, Ian McDonald, Jake Morgan, Tom Scragg, Benjamin Shaw, and Charlie Walker. The Jogcast, May 2017, Extra Edition. Hello everyone, and welcome to the Jogcast. I'm Charlie, and joining me in the studio are Fiona.
Hi Charlie.
Ben.
Hello.
And Jake.
Hello.
In the show this time, Ian answers your astronomical questions, and we interview Dr. Elisabetta Valianti about Herschel Atlas. But first, before all of that, Tom talks to Josh Hayes and James Stringer in this month's Job Bite.
Okay, we've had a question from a number of our listeners about FRBs, or fast radio bursts, and why don't we observe them in the optical wavelengths? Well, we're lucky today, we have two researchers from the University of Manchester with us to talk about just that question. So welcome to Josh Hayes and James Stringer. Josh, do you want to give us a couple of sentences about yourself and what you're doing?
Yeah, so my name's Josh Hayes, as Tom has pointed out. I'm a master's student here at the University of Manchester, and I'm currently working on building a robotic optical telescope in the hope of finding optical counterparts to FRBs.
Excellent. James?
I'm James Stringer. I'm also an undergraduate, fourth year master's student. I'm working on the same project as Josh, so that's about it, really.
Okay, so first question, I guess, is for the majority of our listeners, they've probably heard the term fast radio bursts, or FRBs, but can you tell us, what's an FRB?
So my favourite way of describing what an FRB is effectively is a scream from space. It's a one-off signal that we detect only so far in the radio, and we don't know what's causing them. We've found 21 of them so far. One of them has repeated and seems to be different to the others. But like we say, they're of unknown origin, and people are trying to do all they can to find out more about them, which is what James and I are currently working on.
Yeah, so one of the things that sets them apart from other like similar signals is that they're really bright in the radio band. They're much brighter than any sort of similar source we can see in the radio sky, and that makes them of really good interest for us. Because they're so bright, it means that they're really easy to see, and that means we can use them as a probe for some really interesting physics, some high-energy physics, some cosmology, some other things like that. Another thing that's really interesting about them is that they've got a really high single-digit dispersion measure. It describes basically how the different wavelengths of the radio waves reach us. And basically, we can use it to sort of determine how far away the signal is. And it looks like, from all the signals we've seen, that they all come from outside our own galaxy. And this means that there could be some really cataclysmic one-off events, such as neutron star mergers, flares on very highly magnetic neutron stars called magnetars, and other really big things like that. And these things, we don't have models for how they produce the light. And by observing these FRBs in different wavelengths, such as gamma rays or optical waves, we can sort of constrain these models and basically determine what makes them and how they're made.
Yeah, I've heard it said there are more models for what FRBs are than there are FRBs detected.
Yes. Yeah. My personal favourite is one that I'm convinced is a typo that uses the word supermassive neutron star. It's either a typo or someone attempting to get a new phrase used. I've not seen it anywhere else.
Actually, one of the leading theories is that they're from the collapse of neutron stars into black holes. Mm. And if you've got an overmassive neutron star, then the gravity is too much for the outward pressure of the neutron star to hold, so it will collapse into a black hole. And these one-off events might be what causes it.
The chances are very, very slim, however, that they are from extraterrestrials, which is a theory that often gets bandied about on the internet somewhere. So we've not been not been communicated with by little green men, unfortunately.
That we know of.
Yes.
Probably.
Okay. Do we know that FRBs are visible in the optical wavelength then?
The short answer is no.
The long answer is maybe.
Some of the bursts have been detected in other frequencies. So there's a survey called SWIFT that detected in 2016 a gamma ray source that we've sort of correlated with an FRB source. So that tells us that this source emitted radio waves and gamma rays, which are two opposite ends of the spectrum. So it sort of makes sense that we might be able to see something in the middle of the spectrum in optical, and, well, hopefully we can observe it. But we don't know what it would look like, how bright it would be, what frequency it would be at, really.
This is the problem with having a huge number of models. Each model predicts a different amount of optical light, if any, being emitted. We should also say, though, that the SWIFT survey, the gamma ray object, whilst it appears to be from the same part of sky, we can't be certain that it's from the same object. So it might be that because they're from galaxies that we can't resolve down to the level of individual stars and objects, it may be that it's from two nearby objects and they're unrelated, or it may well be that they are related. The problem...
It's a 3.2 sigma.
Is it 3.2 sigma? Okay, I take that all back.
3.2 sigma?
So sigma is basically a way of sort of describing the certainty of a measurement being true. So saying 3.2 sigma basically means that we're 99.9% sure that these signals are from the same source. So in astrophysics, we tend to be a bit sort of generous with our sigmas. And we take 3 sigma to mean like a good detection. So in particle, for example, they take up to 5 sigma, which is like 99.9999% certain that they're like a definite thing. And it's basically a way of calibrating, like saying how sure we are of something. So we're pretty sure of this.
So it's saying that if we took 1,000 random measurements, one of these measurements would be...
By chance,
would say that these two objects are correlated in some way.
All right, so we hope they're visible at optical wavelengths. We've got an idea they might be, or potentially might be. So tell us what you've been doing about it.
So the main issue when it comes to observing any form of transient, so that a transient is an astrophysical object that changes over time. When you're observing something that is very, very short, so 5 milliseconds for an FRB, say, you can't have a detection triggering an alert to another telescope that then goes, oh, I'll have a look at that. Because by the time you've actually got round to it and started observing, the chances are the thing has gone. So what we are working on is we're building a secondary telescope to the Lovell telescope at Jodrell Bank. It's called Lovell CAM, and it's an optical telescope that will, once it's finished, spend its time basically shadowing the observations of Lovell. So where Lovell looks, Lovell CAM also looks. And if we find that Lovell has detected an FRB at some point, we can go back through the data and the observations of Lovell CAM and hopefully discover a counterpart to such a detection.
So our project was inspired by similar projects, such as UltraCAM, which is used to look for various signals across the sky in a similar fashion. Other ones like MIR-LICT, which is going to be used with the MIR-CAT precursor to the SKA, the Square Kilometer Array Telescope in South Africa. So these are basically optical mini observatories, like on the same site as a big radio observatory. And they're doing what Josh said. So we're looking at the same patch of sky as our Lovell telescope, the big 76-meter telescope at Jodrell Bank, and basically looking at it during the night at least. So looking at it all night to basically correlate what we see with what they see. So if they see a source, like a FRB candidate, at, say, 1 o'clock in the morning, we can go back through our data to 1 o'clock in the morning and see if we've seen anything in that same patch of sky at the same time. And then if we do see something, then potentially it might be a optical counterpart.
What we should say, though, is that MIR-LICT is probably the closest analogue to Lovell CAM. However, it's been designed specifically to target transients that last longer than 1 second. So whilst there is a potential for it to capture FRB counterparts, it's not been designed with that in mind. And so the sort of image timing that it uses means that there's actually quite a slim chance of it capturing such a counterpart.
You must be taking pictures very quickly if you're looking at 5 milliseconds.
So we want to be taking pictures very quickly, but we can't. So our current telescope hardware isn't quite capable enough to do that sort of quick turnover of images. Because we're using quite a basic camera, there's sort of some hardware issues. I mean, we can only take an image every, let's say 10 seconds or so. And so if we had a bigger budget, then we could basically buy some specialist like hardware that means we can take these images as soon as the last one was done.
Lovell CAM is currently in a proof of concept stage, so we are currently constructing the basic framework for such a thing to be created. And once that is complete, we are confident that the university and Jodrell Bank will acquiesce to our demands and allow us to purchase some more high-end equipment, as currently what we're using is basically bits that were found around Jodrell Bank. But I mean, they're still pretty high quality. We are also investigating how well we can observe other types of transients. So longer lasting ones, such as binary star systems, where you can see one star going in front of the other. We're investigating how Lovelcam will respond to other transients. There are thoughts on whether or not we would be able to detect exoplanet transits in a similar method used by the Kepler telescope and soon to be the TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. We will be able to also investigate things called Cepheid variables, which are a type of variable star where we can use measurements of their periodicity to determine a distance to them. So we use them to help measure cosmological distances to nearby galaxies or just to nearby star clusters.
From what you've described, this is a fairly mechanical process. If somebody says, oh, the Lovell's seen an FRB, then you have to go back over the images for the past day or week or however long you install them for.
So it does sound mechanical, but in reality it will be automated. So like if there's a detection at Lovell, then that would be like processed by the computers there, the processors there, and that sort of would set a flag off, and that would tell our software that operates our telescope that the time and the position of the potential source. And then so we'd be working on some sort of software to detect from an image we've taken if there'll be an FRB in there. So we could do this a really easy way by sort of comparing it to the images taken just before and just after it. There won't be that FRB in those two images because it's such a short burst. And that'd be a sort of fairly good idea of if it is there. And then once you sort of narrow down our choice or options, basically, there might well be some sort of component of human interaction with this. So we'd actually go through ourselves and have a look at them and compare. That looks like it's in the same place. It's the same sort of rough brightness, same time. It's not quite as manual as it all sounds. A lot of this is done automated behind the scenes by the software of both Lovell Telescope and Lovell Cam itself. And this is the case with most observatories, actually. Most of the processing is done by computer programs rather than people. I mean, the end result is obviously done by people, but like these telescopes get hours and hours and hours of data, sometimes even days of data, that you couldn't go through by hand, really. And we're sort of using the same ideas as that for ours.
Okay, that sounds good. You mentioned the telescope. What kind of telescope are you using?
Well, we are using an 11-inch reflecting telescope. It's all right for what we're hoping to achieve. However, ideally, we want to be using as large a telescope as possible. Part of what Lovelcam is trying to achieve are observations on a very low budget. There are obviously budget issues at the moment for everyone. And so if we can achieve successful science in this area with relatively little money compared to what is, say, being pumped into the SKA, then we will be able to replicate this as a system at other places. So one of the main issues we have at the moment is the fact that we're trying to build this in Cheshire, which is both quite light polluted and incredibly cloudy, which means that any observations you're trying to do in the optical bands are quite difficult. However, the idea of shadowing observations of another telescope doesn't mean that you have to be at the same location as it. So obviously Lovell is a radio telescope and radio telescopes aren't really bothered by clouds. So Jodrell Bank is primarily a radio telescope. We could theoretically move Lovell Cam to somewhere in the world that was generally clearer at night and with less light pollution. We can still observe the same parts of sky or a lot of the same parts of sky as Lovell, which would mean that we would be in a position to actually start making more regular observations most days of the year, or nights of the year, I suppose I should say.
So our telescope is just an off-the-shelf, commercially available telescope. It's not like a specialist-built piece of equipment. It is.
Everything we are using is commercially available. The telescope setup we have costs less than £4,000.
It's a bit more than your sort of standard telescope,
yeah.
But it's no million-dollar project.
No, I mean, it's well within the grasp of most amateur astronomers.
Mm.
I mean, I know quite a few people that start small and quickly build up to that scale of instrument, that scale of spend on their equipment. So it is perfectly possible.
Definitely, yeah.
To do good cutting-edge science.
I mean, the telescope we are using doesn't even actually belong to Jodrell Bank. It's a telescope that was kindly donated to us by Professor Tim O'Brien, who is the director at Jodrell, or was. I actually don't know.
I'm not sure myself. It does change.
Yes. Whichever hat Tim is currently wearing, at the time he was director.
Yeah, if you're a keen amateur astronomer and you want some on a project for about 2.5 years, then yeah, make your own Lovell cam DIY.
Or alternatively, there is a potential that once Lovell cam is complete, we could put our software out as an open source thing and try and sort of crowdsource some observations of from people who, say, aren't using their telescopes all the time.
That's an interesting concept.
So if there was someone on the other side of the world, so when it's day here, it'd be night there, they could look at the same place Lovell's looking at, and we could get nearly 24-hour observations to match with Lovell, and that'd be double our chances of seeing FRB.
We're also currently implementing the functionality to not just shadow Lovell's observations. So, like, at the moment, we can shadow the observations of any radio telescope on the eMerlin network. So that's 9 telescopes across the UK. But we could also help shadow the observations of ARTHUR and VLBI networks. So these are large interferometers that are continent or even half the world size once you start including Chinese telescopes in the VLBI. That is something that we're hoping will allow us to really start getting some useful data. And once we start getting up to that size, that scale, a network of telescopes is something, a network of cheap telescopes that are still capable of making the observations and detections that we require would be ideal.
Sounds like another research project in the offing. Certainly a development program in there.
Definitely, definitely.
Hopefully.
Okay, just to come back, have you got exams? Are you, do you have to pass an exam at this or submit reports at the end of the year?
Yeah, so we're currently writing up our reports on this. Nice, tasty 30-page report.
And, excellent.
We will be presenting the current status of Lovell Cam and where we're at to the JVCA. We're actually presenting to the group out at Jodrell Bank tomorrow. I don't know if I've told you about this yet, but we are.
I know this. tomorrow being the 10th of May.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yes. Of course, yes. And, I mean, alongside this, we've got a few other exams. After this is my last year on the Lovell Cam project directly. I'm going off to... Well, I'm staying at Manchester, but I will be working to help detect exoplanets and analyse their composition in the hope of working out what on earth a lot of things are made out of.
And I'm moving to the Pulsar group here at Manchester. So I'm going to be working to search for and study extreme neutron star systems called Black Widows and Redbacks. This is where you have a neutron star and a similar size star to our Sun in a very close binary orbit. And we're going to use those to study very high-energy physics, very fundamental physics, and that's my PhD project.
Excellent. So, welcome to the Pulsar group.
Yes.
That's the area I study in. A fellow inmate.
Yes. I, on the other hand, am leaving the Pulsar group. So.
Some people do escape.
Yes.
Okay. I guess this would be a very different interview if we'd actually detected an FRB and we got an optical observation. Any ideas... potentially, how long it could take?
So the current status of Lovell Cam means we have an issue with the true automation of it. So for it to become fully capable of just sort of waking up when it's night, doing some observations and putting itself away, we have issues with the dome that the telescope is currently housed in. If we can sort that and get a new shed for it, effectively, I would say that with some dedicated work, Lovell Cam could be up and operational in about a year, maybe a year and a half.
Even when it is operational, though, the time between it first light and it actually detecting an FRB might be quite a while. So it's estimated that there are 10,000 FRBs from anywhere in the sky in one day, but over the last 11 years, we've only detected 18. Or did you say 21? I think it's 18.
21. Yes, the FRB cat has 18. No, it's got 21.
They've got 21 now. Well,
I checked it this morning.
I'll do my report then. So over the last 10 or so years, they've actually only detected 21 FRBs, as Josh said. That's less than 3 a year. So
I mean, the first one was detected in 2007 by Lorimer. I can't remember where it was, though. Was it Parkes, I think?
Yes, it's old data.
So most of these are from data from the Parkes telescope or the Arecibo telescope, and both of those aren't committed as much to VLBI work or emerging work as Lovell is. So,
however, we do have people here at Jodrell Bank working specifically on FRB detection. So Charlie Walker, who I believe is one of your presenters, works in that area.
Co-executive producer of the Jodcast. Well, so a very busy man.
Yes, it's a very long title.
Yep.
There are people working alongside Charlie who are building pipelines to automate and flag up these detections, which should hopefully make our life on Lovell Cam easier.
But I guess the answer is then we still don't really know.
Yes. The answer to a lot of questions about FRBs is we just don't know.
Okay, and on that note, then we'll close.
Fantastic.
Josh, James, thank you very much. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for that, Tom. Now, Monique and Tom interview Dr. Elisabetta Valiente about Herschel Atlas.
So, hi, I'm here today with Tom Scragg, and we're interviewing Dr. Elisabetta Valiente from the University of Cardiff. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, it's good to have you here, and it's Tom's first time interviewing, I believe.
Yes, first time, so could be a bit stuttery and horrible, but we'll see how we go.
Glad to have you here, and could you start off by just giving us a brief overview of what your research is about?
I work on extragalactic surveys, in particular with Herschel. Herschel is a European experiment that is not flying anymore, unfortunately, but we still have a lot of data to analyze. So I'm a member of Herschel Atlas, that is the biggest extragalactic survey, and we already did the first public data release last June, and we are working for the second data release. So what we observe are galaxies, in particular at high redshift, but also local galaxies, and to observe the galaxies with these instruments, they need to be dusty. So the dustier the galaxies here are, the more stars they form, and we're interested in these galaxies, forming galaxies, because it means they are very active, it means they are creating a lot of stars, they have a lot of energy, and we know that in the past galaxies formed more stars than we do today, so it's very interesting to look at how this star formation changed during the time, looking back in time.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about dusty galaxies, what do you mean by dust, and where does that come from?
Oh, this is a very big question. It is not exactly my topic of research, mm-hmm. but it's a big issue to understand where this dust comes from. It's formed by stars. So we know that in the stars start from hydrogen and they build heavier elements. So eventually we expect these elements to become heavier and heavier. And also in particular, we expect these heavy elements that forms the dust to be formed in supernovae or AGB stars. Mm-hmm. So they are ejected like at the last stages of the life or AGB stars, or they are ejected the dust is ejected when a supernova explodes. Mm-hmm. But it's a topic, it's a very hot topic, and it's not very clear how dust forms and where it comes from, how much is from supernovae, how much is from stars, if it depends by the galaxy, if it depends from other kind of environments, nobody knows.
Oh, that's really great, because I always hear people talk about dust and never knew there was this mystery behind it. Yeah.
I was going to ask, you talk about dust. What's the difference then between dust and gas?
The gas is lighter elements. So the gas is mainly composed by oxygen, carbon, or just hydrogen. Actually, we have molecular hydrogen, atomic hydrogen. This is the kind of gas we see in the universe. While when we talk about dust, it's actually dust. So they are heavy components. They are made by silicate, by chains of carbons. So they are more complex molecules, and they are very important in the star formation because they are very complex molecule. They help the gas to get together. So we know know that to form stars is the gas that has to collapse, but where we have a big amount of dust, this collapse is easier, just because the different molecule of gas get attached to the molecule of dust, and it's easier to collapse them together and to start the gravitational growth that we need to form stars.
So it kind of clumps them together.
Yes.
Which seeds okay. The gravitational collapse.
So that's the reason why the dust is a proxy for star formation. So we measure the dust, and we can say, oh, we measure a lot of dust, we expect a lot of star formation for this galaxy. So for where you are lucky, you can measure independently amount of dust and amount of star formation. But once this thing has been done for a reasonable number of galaxies in different environment, we saw that the two things actually correlate. So now we just, for most of the galaxies, in particular the one at high redshift that are far away from us, so they're difficult to be detected. It's difficult for them to measure the amount of gas. We just measure the amount of dust that is more easier, and we just derive from it the amount of gas and the star formation rate.
That makes sense.
Okay.
So what questions are you trying to answer with Herschel?
Is when most of the stars have been formed, and how is the activity of the galaxies changed? So how much energy the galaxies are emitting during their history? There was one press release, not made by Herschel, but made by another collaboration that is close to our HATAS collaboration. And the press release, the title was "The Universe is Dying." But it was a very fancy and catchy way to see that the universe in the past was much more active and energetic than it is now.
That does sound better. That's true. So in the past, galaxies were much more active. They were creating many more stars and that kind of thing. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And what's the reason for that?
Oh, well, that is another good question. Possibly because we had the biggest amount of gas that hasn't collapsed yet, so it was easier to collapse it together. And also because the universe was smaller. So because the universe was smaller, it was easier for the galaxy to interact together, so to merge and to have closer interactions. It was much more likely. And when galaxies interact together, the gas get compressed and they form more stars. So once the universe is expanded enough, these interactions are less likely, and so it's more difficult to compress the gas and create a big amount of stars. But again, this is another big question, because, for example, there is a theory or a model that is called downsizing that tell us that is what we actually measure, that the biggest galaxies were at the top of their activities in the past, and now they look like dead, so they are not forming galaxies anymore, while now they are the smallest galaxies that are much more active, have the higher star formation rate. So why is this? It's not very clear. Mm-hmm. There are different cosmological models that try to display this, but it's not very clear why the bigger galaxies started to form a lot of stars before and they stopped, mm-hmm. and while the smaller galaxies are doing it now, because mm-hmm. now we observe high star formation rates in very small galaxies, in what we call dwarf galaxies. Mm-hmm. So it's a bigger question why activity was very strong in the past, and another bigger question is why it stopped. So we think that it stopped because at some point an AGN, an active galactic nucleus, formed in the center of the galaxy, mm-hmm. and so all the energy, all the very strong energy from this AGN, just destroyed the molecules of gas or warmed them up, because you get the best star formation when there is cold gas. Because you need it to collapse together. If there is too much energy, if there is too much radiation, you don't get any star formation. So this is one of the theories that try to explain why the star formation was so strong and then eventually stopped.
Mm-hmm. So this idea that at some point the active galactic nuclei are turned on to some extent, and they have an injection of heat and energy.
Yes.
Which would prevent star formation. But then I guess that just passes on the question, because then the question is what caused the AGN?
It's probably just the galaxies assembling together. So I think the very easy picture of this point of view is just at the beginning, there is just gas, and the gas starts to collapse following the gravitational field generated by the dark matter. So you start with dark matter that generates some gravitational field. In some regions, the dark matter is denser than in other regions, so you have the gas falling into this dark matter gravity gravity holes and they start to collapse and form stars. When you have enough, we have to create a galaxy, the stars continue to fall in the center. In the center, in the nucleus, and eventually they will collapse together and form a black hole. Now, of course, the process is not very clear, and probably what I'm saying, because it's not exactly my topic of research, is not 100% correct. Mm-hmm. But when the black hole is big enough, is energetic enough, it starts to emit in X-rays, and then it stops the star formation, and then it becomes a very powerful AGN. So we mm-hmm. expect a massive black hole in the mm-hmm. center of each galaxy. Not all of them become active. So we don't know, for example, we know that there is a galactic black hole in the center of our galaxy, but at the moment, fortunately, it is not active. We don't know if it's been active in the past or not. Mm-hmm.
But it might be one day, possibly. You never know.
I don't think it will become active because our galaxy doesn't have such a strong star formation mm-hmm. rate that will activate the black hole. Mm-hmm. And probably we don't want it.
yeah, that's true. So going back to Herschel as well, because you've been quite involved with Herschel Atlas. So what kind of challenges have there been in that project?
Well, Herschel Atlas is a very, very big survey. So I think the biggest challenge has been sociological, because there are a lot of people in the collaboration, and we have to agree all together, if not all of them, at least the core team has to agree with the major decisions. So it has been hard sometimes to get everybody in agreement with mm-hmm. what we were doing, but we did it at the end. So it was good. It was nice to collaborate with so many people. Mm-hmm. It was nice to help so many people, because I was responsible for the catalogs and the data. Mm-hmm. So everybody writing papers on different topics. Mm-hmm. Eventually they came to me asking a recommendation or suggestions or some help in how to deal with the data, or about the properties of the noise and the properties and the uncertainties on fluxes of single sources. So it was very nice. Mm-hmm. And from the more practical point of view, I have to say that Herschel, Spire in particular, the instrument mm-hmm. we have used for our survey, has been an amazing instrument. It worked mm-hmm. way better than it was expected. Oh. So in principle, H-Atlas was supposed to be a very shallow survey that looked only in the close-by universe. But at the end, we did some high redshift science as well. So mm-hmm. it was just a surprise. We didn't expect mm-hmm. it at the beginning, but the data were good enough to do better than we expected.
Oh, that's always nice to have it that way around. So you mentioned before that you can use dust to trace star formation, and it's much easier to observe like how dusty a galaxy was than it can be sometimes to measure the star formation.
Yes.
Is that right? So what makes it easier to measure the dust than it is to look at the star formation?
Well, to measure the dust is a photometric measurement. So you just need a camera that measures the flux in even one, in the worst case, or two or three different wavelengths. So in our case, we have the Spire camera that measured the emission at 250, 350, and 500 micron, that just trace the peaks of mm-hmm. the emission of the dust. We expect the dust to emit more or less as a black body. Depends if a galaxy is close by or far away, or it depends if a galaxy is cold or warm. The shape, the ratio between the flux in these three wavelengths will be slightly different, but more or less we expect to trace the peak of the dust emission. While for the gas is a spectroscopic measurement. So when you do spectroscopy, you need to measure very shallow lines. So you need mm-hmm. different instruments that are more complicated to build than photometry instruments. And also you need to observe for longer time, because the signal is weaker, extended over a very short wavelength range. Mm-hmm. So it's usually just more expensive from any point of view. Then of course you can do it. You apply for telescope time and you integrate for hours sometimes mm-hmm. and you can measure the lines the molecular or atomic lines for the galaxy you are interested in, but you do it for one galaxy, so sometimes it takes a few hours for each galaxy mm-hmm. while when you do photometry, you just observe a big patch of the sky and you measure thousands of galaxies in it, and you have the fluxes in three bands with just one scan for several galaxies. So mm-hmm. it's much easier and cheaper.
Get more galaxies. And you said you've been involved with compiling the catalogue for Herschel.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not an observational astronomer at all. What does that involve? Because I have no idea.
Well, you have what is called the timeline data from the instrument. So mm-hmm. it means that for each bolometer, you know what. A camera is made by mm-hmm. different bolometers that are the detectors of the instrument. And for each bolometer, you know, you have the information at each time, mm-hmm. What is the position it's looking at, and which is the flux that it's measuring. Okay. So you get, you have several bolometers. Mm-hmm. Actually, I can't say, there are maybe tens, if not hundreds of bolometers in the Spire camera. I'm not sure what is the number. Mm-hmm. But you put together this information from all the bolometers and you build a map.
Okay.
So in the map, you have each pixel in the maps mm-hmm. is one position, and all the informations given by different bolometer about mm-hmm. that position are averaged together. Mm-hmm. So in this way, you have several you have independent information, mm-hmm. independent measurements of the flux in that specific point, mm-hmm. and you put together all the pixels in your map, and you mm-hmm. have information of the flux in small or large, depending how big your survey is, a patch mm-hmm. of the sky. And then once you have your map, you usually also know the uncertainty with each pixel. And then you look for peaks in the signal-to-noise map. Mm-hmm. So in this map, there will be intrinsic noise. So there will be fluctuations that is just noise. When you see a positive fluctuation that is like 2, 3, 4, or 5 sigma, five mm-hmm. times the average fluctuations, you may assume that it's very unlikely that that fluctuation is just noise, but mm-hmm. it will probably be a source. So you just select peaks of the noise. Mm-hmm. If you select 3 sigma or 5 sigma mm-hmm. fluctuations, so you are sure that you only, for example, 0.1% of your sources are fake sources, are just fluctuation of the noise, but all the rest will be real sources. Mm-hmm.
So you have to go through and pick out the sources and...
Well, there are codes that
do so this. It's not a manual thing.
No.
Yeah, I ask.
We passed that point.
In some fields it is. So I always ask. I think that was something that surprised me in astronomy, is how many things are done manually. So I always
very
ask.
Hard work.
It's a computational thing. There are codes look for peaks and they're also able... depending who wrote the code, but they're also able to understand if they are reliable peaks mm-hmm. or not, because of course you know which is the transfer function of the instrument. So what you have in the sky is a single point source, mm-hmm. But what you have in your map is like a round patch. And this depends on the fact that the instrument has a transfer function. So what is a very, very sharp peak, mm-hmm. a delta, will become something that is more spread. It's like mm-hmm. a Gaussian shape.
So it smears it out,
actually. Yes. But we know what is the transfer function of the instrument. Mm-hmm. It's called point spread function. So what we look in the map is for things that have the same shape of the point spread function of the instrument. If something has a weird shape, it's very, very spiky, mm-hmm. maybe it's just a glitch in the electronics, mm-hmm. a glitch and some unexpected noise, but is likely not a source.
Okay. So we've talked a little bit about what you have been working on. What are you looking forward to over the next few years, whether it's in your own work or in the field in general, or for, you know, Herschel data?
Well, regarding Herschel data, regarding the project, we are working for a second data release. So the field we observed was very, very large. There were actually different mm-hmm. fields. So we did a public release last summer for one third of the area we observed, and we plan to, by the summer, a second data release with the rest of the data. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm also working to do science on this data. So I'm working on the number counts, on the AGN content on these galaxies, on the clustering on these galaxies. So I have several projects the students that I follow are working on. For the future, we'll think to cross-correlate this data with surveys that will come. So there is SKA that will cover large portions of the sky in the radio, and so we will use the information we already have about from the far infrared, and we cross-correlate with radio sources, and it will be interesting to see what comes from.
What kind of thing could you expect to learn from that, from the cross-correlation, from looking at the two surveys?
Well, we expect the sources to emit, the star-forming galaxies to emit in the radio as well. There is actually a correlation, a very tight correlation between the far infrared and radio, just because the we have the emission from the dust is is at the far infrared, but the stars, the very young stars that just formed, they emit in the radio because of a synchrotron emission. So they are very tightly correlated because they are mapping the same physical phenomenon that is a very young star, where you have star formation. So on one side we measure the amount of dust that helps the gas to collapse. On the other side we measure the signal that comes from the stars, the very big stars that just formed. So there is a very tight correlation, but having until now it was harder to get measurement, radio measurement from large patch of sky, so we usually have measurements on single object, or there are radio surveys, but they're not so big. But having something like SKA that is be able to do survey on a large area, it might be survey to compare with, given that H Atlas is the largest extragalactic survey made with Herschel, so it's the largest map we have in the far infrared. One problem when you look at the sky is that if you look at a patch of sky that is too small, you have what is called cosmic variance. So you might measure something, you might think you might learn something about the universe, but you are only looking at a very small patch. So maybe you are measuring again a fluctuation, maybe you are measuring something very, very peculiar. It's like if you look at the human body and you only look at the nail, you might think that we are covered like something very hard like nails, but it's just because you are looking a very small patch and you've been lucky because you picked a point that is not very characteristic.
That's a good analogy.
So what it's good to observe large areas because you get a good idea what really is how really is the universe on average, and you can also measure if there are specific things that change on small or large scale. Just because you have such a large area, you can see how the properties fluctuate, and you also can discover very rare objects, because if an object is rare, there are not so, by definition, there are not so many of them, and of course if you look at a very small patch of the sky, it's very unlikely you find it. So looking in a very large portion of the sky is important from this point of view, both to understand how the universe works on average, just having the problem of the cosmic variance, and it's possible to find a very extreme or very rare or very weird objects that are very difficult to find.
Weird is always good in astronomy, I think.
Can I just ask, how long does the survey take actually on Herschel? So how long are you collecting data for? And then how long does it take you to analyze that data to get to the...
I can say how long it took to analyze the data. I'm actually, I can't tell how many hours. I should look at the proposal. I cannot tell how many hours observation time it has been. We observed 600 square degrees. And well, there was a first release. It was just a few months after the observations. So the first portion of the sky, it was 4 by 4 square degrees. It was released quite soon. But then, because we wanted to do a very good job, probably even too much, we spent 4 more years to do this data release with 1/3 of the data. Well, I have to say, what we've learned in these 4 years, it will be applied also to the other 2/3. So we are not spending 2 times more time to release the other maps. But there was so much to analyze and understand about the properties of the noise, about to be sure that the tools we were using, like the code to extract the sources, it was really working and was doing what we expected to do. So when you do this kind of job, you have to run a lot of simulations. So it's not only doing the job once, like extracting the sources and measure the flux. You have to do this job a lot of times on different synthetic maps to be sure that you are doing what you think you are doing and not something else. Because, as you know, probably very even better than me, when you write a code, it's not always true that it does what you want it to do.
No, I think that's a great point, because I think people often think, you know, once you get your telescope and you get an image straight away and you can just go do science, and they kind of forget there's all this processing between and checking that works and all the work that goes into it.
And every instrument's unique, and the way it behaves is different from everyone else.
Yeah, with every instrument, it's always like starting from scratch, because you must tune your chords, you must tune everything for the specifics of the instruments. That's why it's so important to work closer with people that built the instruments or calibrate the instruments or wrote the code, all the codes for the instruments to understand better what's going on.
So thank you very much for coming on the Drodcast, and hopefully we'll have you on again sometime in the future.
I hope so. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Tom and Monique. And now here's some of the stuff we thought you might find interesting, the odds and ends.
My odd and end for this month comes from Houston, Texas, where the main optical assembly of the James Webb Space Telescope has arrived at the Johnson Space Center for a few months of cryo testing. This testing is going to be going on in hard vacuum at a temperature of 50 Kelvin for about 3 months to try and simulate the conditions that the optics will be put through while the telescope is actually out operating in space, such to check whether all of the optics are still functioning and ready as they should be. This is the second round of testing for the JWST optics. It's already passed extensive vibration testing to simulate the conditions that the telescope is actually going to be put through when it launches.
So the vibration testing, what is that?
From what I could tell from the photos, it was just a really big shake table with $4 billion worth of hardware on it.
And now it's going into a vacuum at 50 degrees Kelvin.
Yes. Or at least it will be at 50 degrees Kelvin, because it takes them a month to cool the chamber down.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big chamber.
That big chamber.
To what temperature?
To 50 Kelvin.
Yeah. So as a bit of background, the James Webb Space Telescope is going to be replacing the Hubble, right? That's the idea of it?
Yes. I mean, it is difficult to overstate the expectations that are being put on this instrument.
So what are the improvements that it's going to have over the Hubble?
Well, the main mirror is much bigger for a start. It's 6.7 metres diameter, if my memory serves.
Where are they going to put it?
I believe they're going to put it at L2.
Okay.
Ah, yeah. I love that. We were talking about that in the last show, actually, the Lagrange points and putting stuff up there. It's brilliant. It's like having shelves in space, and you can just kind of you can just kind of leave things on them.
But of course, the obvious disadvantage of that is if anything goes wrong, it's too far away for us to fix it.
Yeah, it's not easy to get to
L2. Ah, it's like the top shelves in my kitchen.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, because of course... Yeah, because Hubble had trouble with its mirrors when it was first launched.
But yeah, and then I was thinking, like, what happens at L2? So they're sending James Webb up there, and suppose they send, like, more stuff up there. Is there a point at which it starts to get cluttered? Can you send too much stuff up there?
I imagine so, yeah.
And what would that look like exactly? Would the point shift, or would...
Well, the point itself arises from the dynamics between the Earth and the Sun.
The gravitational potentials.
I imagine that the amount that you could even put up in a Lagrange point would be so minuscule that it wouldn't shift. You're effectively moving stuff off the Earth a little bit further out.
Yeah.
And as it's just between the Earth and the Sun anyway, you'd have to move a large chunk of the Earth's matter.
L1 and L2 and L3 actually aren't that stable anyway. Yeah. You've got to continuously correct the position of the thing, because it can easily fall out.
I mean, so obviously this is a hypothetical. I don't think humans are going to send that much stuff up there, but it's an interesting...
It sounds like a really horrible exam question.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
L's 4 and 5 are bigger, you can fit more stuff in there and they're more stable, but of course you're not shielded by the Earth in L2. The Earth is in front of the Sun, and so you can keep things cold.
I imagine that a more relevant sort of way of posing this question would be, what if we decided to bring meteorites or asteroids into Lagrange orbits in order to mine them? Because then you'd be bringing...
Then you would be bringing something quite massive.
Yeah.
From somewhere else and using it as matter.
Yeah, it does sound like a nasty exam question. Johnny has 2 apples and 3 oranges. Calculate the mass of the Sun. Anyway, is that everything you had to say about the James Webb Telescope?
I think that's it for now, yeah. The testing is scheduled to begin in July, where they'll start cooling the chamber down, and then it'll be 3 months of testing from the beginning of August.
Okay.
While all that is happening, effectively the other half of the telescope, so that's actually the mounting for the optics, the electronics, the propulsion, that is all currently under construction in California. And so, all things being well, the two halves will then come together for a further round of tests in March next year.
When will it launch?
Oh, yes.
I don't know. I'm not going to answer that. I don't want to tempt fate.
Well, my odd end is another thing about Pluto, which I've talked about a lot on here in the past because I like it. So, as you all know, we know a lot more about Pluto now than we used to, and we're learning new things every day, it seems. There's been some discussion recently, so most of our listeners are probably familiar with the new images that came out of Pluto in the recent past, where you could see a big kind of heart-shaped feature on the surface. And that was very obvious and very easy to spot. What you may not have realised is that there's another feature which people are calling a whale. Whether or not you think it actually looks like a whale is up to you. Just underneath and to the left of the heart, there's a kind of a big dark red sort of patch of Pluto, I guess. So scientists are discussing what might have caused that feature to occur. And there's one school of thought, there's one crowd that are saying, oh, they think it's older than the rest of the surface. They've looked at the colour of it mainly, and they've done tests on the kinds of chemicals that they think it's formed of down here on Earth to simulate the effects of ageing on those chemicals. And they found, even though they don't have 4 billion years to play with down here, they found that given the elapsing of that amount of time, the kind of chemicals that are on there could have generated that kind of colour. So they're saying, oh, it's really old, it's much older than the heart bit. So that sounds all very nice. But then there's another gang of astronomers who are like, no, you're wrong. It's younger, it's newer than the rest of Pluto. And they said, oh, it's plausible that it might be really old if it was a very thick layer, but they think it's not a thick layer. They think it's quite thin, actually, and that it's a thin layer of newer material that's formed due to atmospheric reactions, and methane is somehow involved, and that they think actually it's a thin layer of material that's been deposited over older material.
So how is each of these two groups trying to measure the thickness of that layer, given that's the sticking point?
Well, yeah, exactly. All I know is that the second group say that it doesn't seem to be thick, so they seem to have found some way of measuring it already. What that is, I don't know. I mean, I know they didn't just have optical images, they had multi-frequency analysis of it, so maybe there's something in that that would have given them more information about the thickness, but I'm not sure. Their conclusion anyway is, given all the information that they have, they just don't know, and they're going to have to send more stuff out there.
So, fair enough.
Yeah. Given that none of that equipment has been sent yet, we're probably going to be waiting a while to get answers on this one.
But probably still before JWST.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible.
Yeah, exactly. I guess they're looking at things like craters and other surface features, which are usually like a general rule of thumb that the more craters something has, the older it is. But not necessarily, but they too tend to be correlated because the longer it's been around, the more time they've had to form. The more time.
Yeah.
So there's other things they can be looking at in the meantime. So that's all the news today from Pluto.
Cool. Well, that's as good a reason as any to go back.
Yeah, exactly. Well, absolutely. It would be. I like that they're kind of leaving these sort of cliffhangers to encourage further missions to Pluto. Because you know, if our curiosity isn't piqued, then we won't be bothered to send any more things out there.
Yeah, it's like the issue with Enceladus and how plausible it is that there might be life there. Yeah. That means necessarily that we have to go back and have a look.
Exactly.
Cassini's successor, whatever that may be. Mm-hmm. So talking about things on the surface that tell us about other things, a group at the University of Kansas have done some calculations on what they think the supernova kill zone is with respect to the Earth. So how far can a supernova happen away from the Earth such that we are safe from its effects? And they've looked at some isotopes in the surface of the Earth. The abundance of iron-60 in the Earth is such that there must have been a supernova that impacted the Earth within the last few million years. The reason they know this is because iron-60, to form that you need a very large abundance of neutrons. It's formed by something called the S process in the core collapse supernovae. But iron-60 has a half-life of about 2.6 million years. The Earth is significantly older than that, so if iron-60 had been there when the Earth formed, it would have long decayed by now. So something has put iron-60 on the surface of the Earth, and the only known mechanism for forming iron-60, the only known environment in which there is a sufficient flux of free neutrons, is in a type 2 supernova. So their conclusion from this is that there was a supernova or a pair of supernovae that happened around sort of 2 to 3 million years ago. At that point, that was before there were any humans on Earth. There were mammals, but the genus Homo, of which we are Homo sapiens, wasn't around quite yet. But there were no mass extinctions around that time. But there were smaller local extinctions. There was a high extinction rate overall around that time. And so this prompted this University of Kansas group to go on and look at the effects of supernova on Earth. If a supernova was to happen now, what would the effects be on the Earth? What would the effects be on us? And just how catastrophic would it be? And so you can imagine the scenario where you're walking down the street, you know, having done your shopping, maybe bought a book at Waterstones or whatever, and you see some huge flash in the sky.
Suddenly a massive...
And then your skin starts falling off.
probably not quite yet. You know, there'll be a big flash in the sky. If it was something like Spica, which might blow fairly soon, which is a blue giant star, which is kind of nearing the end of its life, and is near enough possibly to cause a problem, then it would be big enough to be seen during the day. You could quite comfortably read by its light at night. It would cast long shadows, etc. So the first thing we would notice, of course, on Earth is a huge flux of neutrinos, because neutrinos can pass through pretty much anything. They'll just laugh all the way through any material. And they would actually arrive before the light would, because light gets quite easily slowed down by stuff along the way. So the first thing we would see in our neutrino detectors, like Super Kami or Candy or whatever, is a huge flux of neutrinos. The light would arrive and it'd be nice. It'd be there for a few weeks before it eventually died down. And so what this group did was look at the different things that from a supernova that could actually hurt you. So the kinetic impact, the stuff that comes off it hitting the atmosphere. They put a model supernova 50 parsecs, so 163 light years away from the Earth, and just simulated what would happen to the Earth. The kinetic impact would be quite low, because we actually aggregate quite a lot of stuff over the course of a day anyway, just from meteor impacts. At 50 parsecs, 163 light years, we're not going to get much more than that from a supernova at that distance. Might see a little blip in the amount of stuff we accumulate, but nothing more. The light from it, as I said, it'd be easy visible during the day, but really it's just going to be annoying more than anything else if you're trying to sleep. Neutrino flux, you know, if a neutrino strikes a bit of DNA, it could cause a cancerous mutation, but the chances of that are quite low. And for you to be destroyed by neutrinos, a supernova would have to be at the position of the sun, which of course isn't going to happen. Our sun isn't going to do that. The biggest danger is from gamma rays, x-rays and cosmic rays. We are shielded quite well from ultraviolet rays by our atmosphere. But of course, gamma rays and X-rays, which are quite high in flux away from a supernova, have the effect of destroying ozone. And if you destroy ozone, you then allow all this ultraviolet stuff to come to the surface, where it would destroy algae, which is, you know, the base of the food chain, and it would basically interact with your DNA, cause mutations that would lead to cancers. And so the impact on us from a supernova within 163 light years is that there'd be a big flash in the sky, everybody would get back to their business, and then everybody would pretty much get cancer.
Wait, that's so what would happen?
Yes, within 163 light years, if a supernova goes, but there will be mass extinctions on Earth, but protracted ones. It wouldn't be an instantaneous event.
Is that over the entire Earth? Because surely it would only be one side of the Earth that was facing a supernova. Would that destroy the whole ozone layer over the whole of the Earth?
The problem is it would ionise the atmosphere, and that front of ionisation is likely to propagate around the atmosphere. So you may well get global mass extinctions. Basically, you're unprotected from the UV radiation from the sun after this thing's hit the atmosphere, and so that's not going to be good for any of us. The reason we can survive down here is because we've got the atmosphere. If you're an astronaut on the International Space Station, this supernova goes off, you're dead instantly. But because we've got the atmosphere down here protecting us, it makes that process much longer.
So why did they take this 50 parsec radius, this 160 light years?
I think they did a number of simulations, but along some line between 10 light years through to thousands of light years, and just decided where the safe limit was.
Okay,
and
so this is the limit.
Yeah, that was at 160.
And how far away is Spica?
Spica is 250 light years away. So it's outside of that range, but there's a lot of things about supernovae we don't know. So if you're wrong by a factor of two, that makes Spica dangerous. And so it's something we've got to keep an eye on for that very reason. Just, you know, if a supernova goes off nearby, even if it doesn't have that much of an impact on us, the cosmic rays, the gamma rays and stuff are going to interfere with things like our power grid and cause lots of problems for people who rely on electricity, which is most of us. You might remember in the 80s or 90s in Quebec, a big solar flare knocked out most of their power for quite a few days, which caused a lot of people to effectively freeze and have quite a bad time until their heating came back on. And so these are real problems that we have to solve. This isn't just some abstract thing that might happen, and if it does, we're doomed anyway. We actually have to think about what the probability is of this happening, because just knocking out our power grid is one thing, or just triggering a mass sort of cancer cluster across the entire Earth is also something that we have to consider. And we need to protect our astronauts that are on the International Space Station. So if the probability turns out to be very high, the kill zone is very large, then we need to get them down. As it is, it's actually, there aren't many stars that can cause us a problem within that radius, so we should be okay. That's true of core collapse supernova. If there are systems within that radius that can accrete and trigger a Type 1A supernova, then of course the probability is a little bit higher. And we don't know what the Type 1A supernova candidate population is in that region. And so there's still a lot of uncertainty around what.
Some NOVAs are type 1A candidates. My NOVA is 1.5 kiloparsecs, so that's further isn't it? That's well outside that range.
Yeah, we're safe from yours.
Yeah. Good, because like it's not that interesting. I don't think it's going to do anything anyway.
We could bring our astronauts down if you find it's really likely. But in terms of the ozone layer getting shot, there's not much you can do about that. You can't stop that, right?
No.
So what do they say? Wear lots of sun cream.
Or... well, even sun cream wouldn't really help you. I mean, there is no solution to this. If this happens, it happens. It's unavoidable. It's unpredictable. There's really not a great deal we can do other than just burrow underground. But even there, cosmic rays will still get us. And so it is just one of those things that we need to know what the probability of this is. But in the event that it happens, there's nothing we can do about it. But it has implications for things like the Drake equation as well, because it tells us something about what the mean lifetime is of an intelligent civilization.
Is that already factored into the Drake equation?
Yes. Yeah, it's the last
but
term.
It's not well constrained.
Yeah. It's not constrained at all.
No.
Yeah.
It's just a giant question mark.
And so if you can say something about, you know, if you're at this point in a galaxy, the number of stars around you is this, therefore... this many of them are likely to go supernova, therefore the mean lifetime of a civilization at this point in a galaxy is this number. Then that helps. So, scary.
So we can move on from grumpy old stars having tantrums to baby stars having tantrums. But let's move back a bit. Did you know that the Earth is a little bit weird?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So let's speed back to the way solar systems form, because this is what my on end talk's all about. So at the moment we think that solar systems form from large clouds of dust and gas called nebulas, which are pulled inwards, and the core collapses into the kernel of a new star, and as the cloud shrinks, it speeds up in its rotation, and the outer cloud flattens into a disk, which is called a protoplanetary disk, and this is where the planets form. So within this disk, you get your clumps of ice and dust, which collide with each other, and some of them accumulate, and eventually, these accumulations of ice and dust get big enough that they gain their own gravitational potential strong enough to form planets. And so the theory goes, in the inner solar system, it's very hot, it's close to the center of the star, and so you will get rocky planets forming. And this is because the temperature is hot enough to sort of melt the rock a little bit more, make it a bit sticky, because rock isn't generally that sticky. Rocks bounce off each other, etc., etc. In addition to that, the gas is all sort of ionized, so that's less likely to accumulate. So you get rocky planets with thin atmospheres, aka Mercury, Venus. Well, Venus has quite a thick atmosphere, but Earth, but not compared to the outer planets, the gas giants, for example. Now, in the outer solar system, you cross what's called the frost line, and then that is cold enough for ice to condense, and there's a lot more gas, and so you form your gas giants. And it's also too cold, really, for rock to condense, and so you get your outer planets, which are more like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, etc., etc. And so this has always sort of been the theory of how planets form, and this is how solar systems form. Now, this has been sort of called into question in some ways, because we've been detecting exoplanets, we've been detecting planetary systems recently, and what we've found is that this is indeed the case. We've got lots of very close together rocky planets, and obviously we detect more gas giants because they're easier to detect. But when you actually do the maths on our own solar system, what you find is that the Earth and also Mars are quite strange, because they lie outside of the line where it's easy for rocky planets to form, beyond the line where it is efficient for rocks to clump together. So there are all sorts of theories about why this could be the case. You can get around this by making rocks stickier. So here's the science of sticky rocks here. People have tossed out ideas, for example, well, rocks could be slightly magnetic, that could cause bigger effects, or they could gain sticky organic coatings, for example. They also say that maybe rocks just get really lucky. You get a very lucky grain.
I'm a lucky rock.
which is lucky enough. Well, it's a probability argument. You'll get one grain that is statistically unlikely that it will form a planet, but you have enough of them that eventually one will. They call those lucky grains. There are problems with all sorts of things. The lucky grains have to be really lucky. It's statistically very unlikely that these will form planets anyway, at the sort of distances of Earth. There are problems with the amount of carbon that actually exists on the Earth. So where carbon-based life forms, you'd think that there's lots of carbon. However, there's not actually enough to account for the sticky organic coatings that would be necessary to cause the Earth to form at this distance. People have tossed out ideas of Jupiter having a sort of a resonance which causes planets to drift, etc., etc., and things to move out and drift in all sorts of directions. But there is another idea which has been put forward by Dr. Alexander Hubbard at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And so this is a nice sort of very well-contained idea which sort of explains
solar systems like the Earth. It explains the place in the Earth. It explains the lack of carbon and sticky organic molecules on the Earth in quite a concise way. In 1936, a certain star was detected called FU Orionis, and it was a baby star, and it was seen to outburst, so it suddenly got 100 times brighter, hence hotter, and that's lasted decades, this sort of outburst from this sort of type of star.
So that's presumably going to have a permanent effect on whatever system is forming around it.
Well, it'll have an effect for as long as that outburst lasts, and lots of stars have been seen to do this recently. So a large proportion of protoplanetary disks have been suspected to undergo at least one of these outbursts in their lifetime. And so this guy ran the maths, and he calculated that indeed this outburst, as you say, would cause the heating line.
Right, exactly. It would just inject more energy into the system.
Exactly. Yeah, the protoplanetary disk would be hotter further out. And it would be hot enough to form a rocky planet out until about the distance of the Earth.
That's interesting.
Okay.
Mm. And so you could then argue, well, what about Mars? Mars is still rocky, but Mars is very small. And so arguments for Mars being small could be, well, if this thing gets less efficient as you get further out from this cutoff, it's not like a hard cutoff, obviously. It's not one temperature and then suddenly it's freezing. It drifts off. So there will still be some rocks that can clump together, just not enough to cause a large planet to form. It makes sense as to why the rocky planets get bigger and bigger and then suddenly Mars is very small. Yeah, so to wrap this up, it also has implications for why there's less carbon than you would have expected on the Earth as well, because if the protoplanetary disk is hotter out to the distance of
it then becomes more difficult for those volatiles.
It burns them off, so that would decrease the amount of carbon found on the Earth. So it answers lots of nice little questions one after the other. Obviously, this hasn't been proven, but it's a theory that's been put forward.
It would be interesting, like, they could presumably work out how many outbursts our sun would have had to have had to provide enough heat to form rocky planets out to where it has done, and then you could compare that with the age of the sun and find out if it's possible.
Exactly. I was thinking that another way that you could test this is you could look at the proportion, because at the moment there are sort of two different types of solar system that have been discovered. Ones like the Earth's and ones where all the rocky planets are indeed very close to the centre of the star. So what you could do is you could look at the proportion of stars that you see doing this sort of outburst and a proportion of solar systems of each type, and then see if there are any links there. So I think that's the sort of thing they want to look into next, because obviously this is a hard theory to prove.
But
it's interesting, and it just ties lots of things up in a nice little bow. So you never know.
I like it when that happens. That's always good.
And so anyway, now for someone who's definitely not wearing a bow, here's Ian with Ask an Astronomer.
Hello and welcome to Ask an Astronomer for May 2017 Extra. I'm here with Ian MacDonald. Hi Ian.
Hello.
And we have three questions for you today, the first being from Francis Cairns, who asks, my understanding is that the expansion of the universe is accelerating and dark energy is used to explain this. Is it possible that the Big Bang is still happening?
Well, to answer these questions, we need to first examine what dark energy and dark matter are. And the simple truth of that is that we don't know. There's a lot of clever theories, and there's a lot of good measurement, so we can certainly say a lot of what dark energy and dark matter aren't, but not an awful lot about what they are. One of the primary missions of the Hubble Space Telescope was to measure the expansion of the universe from the light curves of supernovae. And astronomers using data like this have found that the Hubble parameter, which measures how fast the universe is expanding, seemed to be increasing. We can get similar information out of the cosmic microwave background and how that relates to the large-scale structures that we see in the universe and how they grow over time. And what these combination of data mean is that the universe's expansion has been accelerating. Now, this acceleration normally requires some sort of energy, so we've called it dark energy, because we can't see where it's coming from. And that's just a term that we use to describe it. All we really know is that something seems to be responsible for something like 68% of all of the energy in the universe, and we can't see what it is. So we don't really know what dark energy is, how it relates to the Big Bang, or what other roles it might have in the universe. And although it now seems unlikely, it is still possible that we're missing something in the understanding of supernovae and large-scale structure, which means that we're interpreting the measurements wrongly and that dark energy doesn't exist. Discovering exactly what dark energy is could be as important as Einstein's E equals mc squared. And understanding what it is may seem esoteric at first, but if you think about the things that Einstein's theories have made possible, nuclear energy, GPS, and many other things we take for granted, the amount of effort that's going into measuring and quantifying dark energy and dark matter to work out what they are is probably time very well spent.
Okay, thanks Ian. So our second question comes from Mark Leach, and Mark asks, what shape is a millisecond pulsar? are the conditions so extreme that general relativity must be taken into account?
Well, the shape of any object in space depends on the forces acting on it. Neutron stars are some of the densest forms of material that we've observed that haven't collapsed into black holes. So the main force that we need to worry about in this case is gravity. Gravity pulls an every dense object into a spherical shape, whether it's a planet or a galaxy cluster or a neutron star. But rotating objects, like millisecond pulsars, also suffer centrifugal acceleration, which tends to flatten them out into a disk. If you look at something like the Earth, it's flattened by about 1 part in 300. The diameter between the Earth's poles is actually about 27 miles less than across the equator. And the faster an object's spinning, the greater the amount of flattening. So if you look at Saturn, it's actually flattened by about 10%, making it the least round planet in the solar system. Now, we know of a lot of rapidly spinning stars that are even faster than this. If you look at Altair, for example, it's about 20% flatter at the equator than it is at the poles. Now, Altair rotates at something like 286 kilometers per second, and if it were rotated to about 400 kilometers per second, it would be so flattened that the rotation would be faster than the star's escape velocity. So material would fly off the star, and this is called the breakup velocity. Now, millisecond pulsars normally form in binary systems, where one star is a normal star and the other star is a neutron star. If the neutron star can steal material from the ordinary star, then that material falls onto the surface of the neutron star at a very fast speed, making it spin even faster. The fastest spinning pulsar we know of is PSR J1748-2446AD, nice telephone number, which spins at about 716 times a second. Now that's pretty fast. We don't really know a great deal about the pulsar, about the radius or the mass, which define its shape. But we do know that it must be between about 1.4 and 2 times the mass of the Sun. It must also be at least 4 kilometers across, otherwise it would be a black hole. And based on what we know about neutron stars, it should be less than about 16 kilometers across. Now, if you stick these numbers into the equation that we use to calculate the flattening ratio of spherical objects, you'll find that the diameter across the poles is likely to be something between 1% and 58% less than the diameter of the equator. So if you wanted to think about it in terms of earthly objects, it's somewhere between the shape of a Malteser and an M&M, but not quite as fat as a Smartie. Now, that information is very difficult to find on Google, so I've got to thank Philip Lurcher and Mrs. McNeese of Syracuse Junior High School in Utah for that particular nugget of information. Now, for millisecond pulsars, relativity is important, because the equator could be going around at anything up to a quarter of the speed of light. The gravitational acceleration at the surface must also be at least half the speed of light. So there's various relativistic effects that can become important, like rotational frame dragging and gravitational time dilation, but these will have a much smaller effect on the shape of the pulsar itself. But curiously, relativity might actually define the maximum rate at which pulsars can spin. Pulsars are thought to have tiny irregularities in the surface. They're called mountains, but they might only be an inch tall. But those inch-tall mountains would be enough that any pulsar spinning any faster than J1748 would actually slow down because of the emission of gravitational waves. And it's a rare example of something the size of a pebble that can slow down an entire star. The maximum speed at which pulsars can spin therefore tells us quite a lot of interesting information about how matter behaves in extreme environments, which we can't currently create on Earth.
And our final question comes from Phil Rushton, who asks, is there some kind of balance in the solar system in the distribution of the planets? The larger gaseous ones are at a medium distance from the Sun, and the smaller rockier ones are closer in and further out. Could this distribution in time and space have affected the chances for life developing?
Well, yes and no. We've got a pretty good idea about how planetary systems can form, and they all seem to start in roughly the same way. The gas clouds that form stars have some sort of internal motion, just like clouds on Earth are in motion. So when a star collapses out of this cloud, conservation of momentum takes over. The same principle is used by ice skaters when they go into spins. As the star collapses, this spin gets faster, just like the neutron star we talked about. And the system gets flatter, with a central core, which it becomes the star, and a surrounding disk of gas and dust. It's this disk that forms the planets, as dust grains stick together to form pebbles, then boulders, then asteroids, and finally building themselves up into planets. But this protoplanetary disk starts out being very cold, and as the star starts to heat up, it warms up, and this evaporates any volatile material near the star.
Thanks for that, Ian, and now on to the feedback.
Okay, to start things off, before we get on to the feedback,
We just want to apologise. The Jogcast May edition did go out about 15 days late. It went out when the extra probably should have gone out. And that was thoroughly beyond our control.
Just after I'd recorded Ask an Astronomer with Ian McDonald, I tried to upload the file to our server, realised that our server wasn't listening, went into the room where the server is to have a look at it, and found that somebody had not only pulled the network cable out of the socket, but pulled the socket out of the wall as well. We think we have a pretty good idea who that was.
Yes, but they should remain unnamed.
Yeah.
But that was just one of the problems.
But what we also found when we took the machine apart to see why, once we plugged it back in, it still wasn't connecting, is the CPU fan had died. And so we effectively had to do a copy of the entire Jodcast back catalogue to a new machine, which took quite a while. And then we had a number of dependency issues with the software that we used to actually make the Jodcast. And so,
but I mean, at least we're now not running on Python like 0.0 anymore.
Yeah, so I mean, rest in peace, Barnard. You've served us well. Mm. Thank you for your years of service. But it was time that you left. So
it was.
Good night, sweet prince, I think is the...
It had been given us signs that it wanted to go to sleep permanently for a while. And so now we have a shiny new server, which is in Iraq with a load of other machines that are all maintained much more closely than our old one was.
So hopefully that will mitigate
problems.
Hopefully
they're safe from the Jodcast saboteur.
Yeah. So if you've been following us on Twitter or Facebook, we'll have kept you informed about the outage. If neither of those in your general day-to-day social media life, then that's why we were late. So apologies for that. So we have some...
We have some postcards.
Post?
Yeah, we have some postcards. Mm. Two postcards today, which is really exciting. You know how much we love postcards. So we've got one here from Mark Foskey in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who says, I've been listening to your podcast for years and I thought you would use some more post. You thought right. I love the way you get into real technical details. So few science podcasts or popular articles do. Keep up the good work. Mark Foskey. And it's a lovely postcard with a picture on the front of the Sundell Garden at Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So that's really nice.
So we also have another postcard from Francis Day, who is one of our regular Facebook commenters. We actually received this postcard a while ago, but then we went to record at Jodrell Bank and I didn't take it with us, and so this is the first chance we've had to actually read it. And Francis says, just returned from the magical La Palma, had a tour of the Herschel telescope and went to a Mirador at 3 a.m. and saw the Milky Way. Seeing all the telescopes at the top of the volcano was a fabulous experience. I'm so jealous of professionals who get to work there.
So am I.
Oh, no. Oh, I did an observing run at not La Palma, but Teide and Tenerife once, and there was a lot of cockroaches.
Oh.
So did we go to a different tidy? Because when I went, it was beautiful.
I mean, it was nice, but like, I was awake all day because I can't sleep during the day, even if I've been up all night, and nobody else was awake. And I was reading these really creepy Daphne du Maurier short stories, and I was just there with the lizards and the insects in the sun all day long while everyone else was asleep. And I think I kind of lost my mind a little bit.
Did you look out from the side of the mountain just see a sea of clouds?
Yeah, I just, yeah. It was trippy. I'm not going to lie. It was bad for my mental well-being. So you know, Francis, it's not for everybody, but it is for some people. I mean, I know other people who've been up there, like Charlie, you were there.
I had a great time. Yeah, exactly. It was my second year of university. I went for a week and it was amazing.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's gorgeous. It's lovely. It's beautiful up there.
I'll stick to radio astronomy because I can do that during the day.
Stay on the ground and avoid the altitude sickness. And yeah, you don't have to wake up at night.
Francis signs off with Jod On, the best podcast out there, from Francis Day. So thanks very much for that. And the picture is of one of the telescopes on La Palma with the Milky Way arcing overhead. I can see some familiar features in there, like the Coalsack Nebula. It's a really lovely postcard and it will look well on our wall.
Yes.
Thanks very much. So that's it for feedback. And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that, like Mark and Francis, you can send us post, and the address is on the website.
And all that's left now is for the thank yous. So thank you very much to Dr. Elisabetta Velianti for the interview. The editors were George Bendo, Matt Malenta, Tom Scragg, and Damien Trin. And the producer was Benjamin Shaw. Until next time.
Jog on!